Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Debate, the Peace Prize, and beer in a can. Yes, it's been a strange week in business news. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 12th of October. Good to have you all with us. The economic news of the week this mid-October comes politically tinged, debates and predictions and deficits. So that's where we're going to start. Our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond this week features Felix Salmon from Reuters. He blogs there. Lee Gallagher is at Fortune Magazine. They are in our cozy, cozy New York studios. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hello, Kai.
So you watched the debate last night, Felix?
I did. It was fun.
It was, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah. Much better than the first one.
Yeah, yeah. All right. I want to play a piece of tape, and then I want to talk about what it said, because there were all kinds of economic things, but we're going to pick one. Here you go.
So will both of you level with the American people? Can you get unemployment to under 6%, and how long will it take?
I don't know how long it will take. We can, and we will get it under 6%.
Congressman Ryan got the same question, said in essence the same thing. Felix, can they?
No, they can't.
All right.
And they won't.
No, I'm just kidding.
And I don't know where Martha Raddatz got her 6% number from, and I don't know. I mean, I guess once they were, it was dropped in their laps, they had to say yes.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it's like it's the rule. It's like improv. Yes, and you know,
yeah,
she introduced
right.
it, and there was no. The answer was not going
to
be no.
Yeah, you can't respond to that question and say no. I think we're going to basically
but
go to seven and stop. But that's realistically all they can promise.
Yeah, didn't Governor Romney a couple of months ago say I want to get unemployment to 5%? I mean. You know.
Yeah, he also said that he was going to get growth up to 4% per annum, and that he was going to cut taxes without raising. You know, I mean, it's with it.
Yeah.
You can promise lots of things. It's malarkey. I tell you,
all right.
It's malarkey.
You're going to ruin this little bit we've got coming up later in the broadcast. So hold on a minute on that one. Let's get to some substantive economic news. J.P. Morgan reported profits this morning. Wells Fargo also reported profits. Lee, they're doing pretty well. The big banks are, yeah.
They are. And specifically with in the case of J.P. Morgan, it was due to mortgage revenue being up. But interestingly, you know, it wasn't new home buyers. It's the bulk of that activity is refinancing, which tells us that, you know, it's a lot of the low interest rate environment. But you know, people aren't out there buying new homes in the way that we would hope they would yet, even though the housing market does seem to be turning up a little bit.
Yeah, does it matter?
People can't buy new homes because they can't get mortgages.
Right,
and they don't have the down payment saved up, and the banks won't lend them the money if they don't have the down payment. So there's lots of churning in the mortgage market. People are paying off old mortgages and refinancing into new mortgages, and that's just financial noise, really. It's not real, genuine economic activity.
But Felix, when the CEO of the biggest bank in the country says, and this is a quote, we believe the housing market has turned the corner, can we not take that at face value?
I think when the CEO of the largest bank in the market says, we believe the housing market has turned the corner, what he means is, we believe the mortgage market is making lots of profit for us. He's not a home builder. If home builders start saying that, then I'll take them
through. But look at home builders. Home builder stocks are going bananas right now.
Yeah.
I mean, but I think the important thing to note there is that a lot of the activity in the home building sector is multifamily. So there is a major shift happening in the housing market.
From purchasing to renting, which is a good shift in the grand scheme of things.
But
it doesn't bode well for house prices.
Didn't we see, Felix, earlier this week, a couple of days ago, foreclosure activity is at a multi-year low, right?
Which is also a little bit weird because there's a huge backlog of defaulted and delinquent mortgages which hasn't been cleared. So it's not obvious what's going to happen to those. But with all of these lawsuits hanging over the head of the banks, they don't want to be foreclosing now.
And it was interesting that J.P. Morgan, while it lessened the amount of money it reserves for defaults, it increased the amount of money that it puts for legal expenses, which I thought was a very telling sign of the times.
I wonder what they've got going on. All right, Lee, very quickly, because we got like half a minute and we're going to do a little bit on this later in the broadcast. The Nobel Peace Prize to the Europeans, is that going to help solve things over there any faster?
I think it's sort of akin to what in parenting is known as positive reinforcement.
Also, wishful
everyone's
thinking,
doing well. Keep doing what you're doing. Let's not let things fall apart because it would be really, really bad.
Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Felix Salmon from Reuters. See you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. We'll see you. Bye-bye. On Wall Street today, traders ended mixed in a disappointing week. We will have the details when we do the numbers. All right, now a story that combines somehow hydraulic fracturing and higher education. Pennsylvania's economy has been transformed by fracking for natural gas. Landowners have benefited. The companies doing the drilling have benefited. And a new law would let state-owned universities get in on that action, too. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Troe has the story.
Schools in Texas, Ohio, and West Virginia are already exploring oil and gas drilling. Indiana State signed a contract with Pioneer Energy this year. Diane McKee is vice president for business affairs.
In fact, today they are on campus doing some seismic testing.
If they do find oil, the school gets 15% of the revenue. But that would not mean derricks on campus, she says. New technology, horizontal drilling, means the dirty work can happen miles away. Anything on campus,
it will all be screened from view with landscaping and that type of thing.
In northern Pennsylvania, Mansfield University might do the same. It's 175 acres right on top of the Marcellus Shale, a vast reserve of natural gas. Pennsylvania's law says state-owned schools, like Mansfield, get 50% of royalties from drilling on their property. Interim University President Alan Golden says his school has not had any direct conversations about fracking on campus.
Prior to this legislation, there was, no reason to do that.
Because before, the money would have gone to the state. The new law affects the 14 schools in the Pennsylvania state system of higher education. Vice Chancellor Karen Ball says those schools' budgets have been cut 18%. I asked if she thinks fracking royalties can make up that gap.
Now, I don't think it'll be anywhere near the volume. It could be the trade-off.
Natural gas is so cheap right now, she says, that the incentive to drill anywhere is low. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Our education correspondent Amy Scott has been spending a lot of time at a public school in Cincinnati, Ohio, that's doing something a little bit different. Instead of just relying on education to help kids get out of poverty, the Euler School is trying to improve their overall environment as well. They've got a health clinic on campus, therapists, and dental care. Today, it officially added another service, even more basic, because if you can't see the board, you can't learn, can you? Here's Amy.
Walk into Euler School and take a right past the office and through a set of double doors. And you'll find what basically looks and sounds like a lens crafter's. There's a waiting room with a front desk and big pictures on the walls of smiling kids wearing glasses. In a small room in the back, Timothy Driftmeyer, 13 years old with a mop of blonde hair, settles into a big doctor's chair for his first ever eye exam.
So first I want to talk to you a little bit about how you think your eyes are working. Do you feel like you see pretty well?
Optometrist Beth Munzel starts with some questions.
Not so well up close. And when you read, do you have to, close one eye, or do you follow along with your finger, or are you able to follow along just with both eyes open? You do use your finger when you read. Okay.
That's not a good sign. At this age, Tim's eyes should be able to track across the page and jump from focusing at a distance, say on the chalkboard, to the book on his desk. In 7th and 8th grade, the text gets a little smaller and kids read longer passages. Tim has noticed in his English class.
We got a book, it's a novel, and she tells us to read at least two or three chapters a night, and I can barely read it.
So your eyes are working a little bit too hard when you read. Because when you're spending all your energy trying to get the letters into your brain, is it harder for you sometimes to remember what you read after you've been reading? Yeah.
And that's going to make it a lot harder to learn.
If the kids can't see the chalkboard, they can't read the books, they can't read the text, it damages them all the way through and has a huge impact on student achievement.
That's Euler's principal, Craig Hockenberry. It's not that kids at the school weren't getting their vision tested. In Ohio, as in most states, school nurses give basic eye screenings every few years. Can you read the eye chart, tell green from red? Hockenberry says every year, around 140 Euler kids fail that screening.
In the past, we get one chance to load them all on a bus if their parents sign the form and if they're here that day to get them glasses.
Students that didn't make it that day were out of luck. People in this neighborhood don't have a lot of money. Marilyn Crumpton with the Cincinnati Health Department says even parents with Medicaid can't always get their kids to the eye doctor.
Sometimes it's a choice between going to the grocery or taking that bus trip. Poverty interferes with children getting health care.
Now those kids can walk down the hall during lunch or gym class and take home free glasses within a week or two. The clinic is a partnership between the city and several nonprofits. One of them is a charity called OneSight. It's funded by the company that owns LensCrafters and Pearl Vision and the Sunglass Hut. OneSight's Jason Singh says within the first year, the clinic should pay for itself by billing Medicaid.
It's the first what we would call self-sustaining school-based vision center. And so we really hope to replicate this model nationwide.
Euler's clinic won't just treat Euler kids. 2,000 to 3,000 students from all Cincinnati public schools will come here for exams.
Okay. You want to come up with me and we'll take a look at the glasses that we've got? And then after
now the fun part, Tim Driftmeyer gets to pick out his glasses. Technician Courtney Calvin slides open the glass case and pulls out several frames.
No? Okay. As you know what you don't like.
Tim tries on pair after pair and frowns at the mirror.
These look sort of girly.
They look girly? Let me see.
Okay, I have to weigh in here. I'm sorry.
Remember, Tim is in eighth grade, arguably the most awkward year ever. He just looks so unhappy with his choices.
What about these ones that are a little more square?
Well, he has to get those. That's the case that they kind of... him choose from these two.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Like most of the kids at Euler, Timothy is covered by Medicaid. Yeah. And Medicaid only pays for certain frames. I feel like a jerk for butting in, but Tim seems emboldened. He points to another case.
You see one of here?
Yeah, the black and gray one's in third row.
Okay, cool. Let me see. Smooth. You like those better than all these?
Yeah, these are the best.
All right. I think you made a good choice, my friend.
Happy, Tim heads back to class with a note from the doctor, permission to skip his homework, thanks to the powerful eye drops he had to take. But the next morning, I find him back at the clinic, trying on frames again. Turns out the glasses he liked, he could only get in purple.
Yeah, I liked them, but it just wouldn't be right for a boy.
He finds a new pair, very masculine, with wire rims, he likes even better. In Cincinnati, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
I do love that she helped them out, right? There's a shot of Tim in his new glasses and the rest of the stories in Amy's series about Euler. It's online at marketplace.org. Coming up, we got beer, good beer, in cans.
The materials are less expensive. The shipping is less expensive. It keeps all light out, even better than a bottle. And they're great for hiking.
Yeah, but it's cans. All right, but first, let's do the numbers. So despite the highest consumer sentiment number in 5 years, it was kind of a blah day on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials eked out a gain of 2 points, finished at 13,328. The NASDAQ dropped 5 points, 0.2%, 3,044. The S&P 500 off 4 points, 0.3, ended at 1,428. All three indices down for the week, the biggest drop since June, by the by. The Dow and the S&P lost 2% apiece. The NASDAQ took off 2.9% for the week. Financials headed downhill. Morgan Stanley lost 3%. Wells Fargo discounted 2.5%. In the positive column, Walmart rose 1% on some good sales it reported earlier this week. Home Depot built on almost 1% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note, why it fell. 1.66% is the yield, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences is announced. It's Global Hand Washing Day, promoting hand washing with soap to prevent diseases. It's aimed at kids, but everyone can participate. And the television sitcom I Love Lucy premiered on October 15th, 1951. Do you miss Lucy? Fortunately, the show is still in syndication. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are deep, as you might have heard, into the 2012 Nobel Prizes, Medicine, Physics, Chemistry, and Literature so far. The Economics Prize is Monday. Bit of a surprise this morning, though.
The Nobel Peace Prize for 2012 is to be awarded to the European Union.
You're wondering what the winners of that Peace Prize are thinking? Us too. So we asked them.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
We've got Sophie Petter from The Economist in Paris, Mario Efthymiopoulos from Strategy International. He's out of Thessaloniki, Greece, and Miguel Ancho Morado from Madrid. They are all on the line. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you all for joining us. Sophie Petter, let me start with you and ask you your gut reaction. What did you think when you heard this today?
I have to say I was surprised. I didn't see this coming at all, and I think that probably reflects a fair amount of the reaction here. People were, we're very much in the middle of a Eurozone crisis, as you know, and the French are feeling the pinch. So the idea that there is now this sort of prize in recognition of something which is quite different is not at all the economic achievement, it's the political achievement.
Miguel Ancho, what's going on in Madrid? Are people paying attention to this?
Well, Spain actually, as you know, has a special relationship with Europe. We are very pro-European. We all have this this idealistic view of Europe, which this prize represents. But then at the same time, we are not an important country in Europe, and this is clearly seen now because of the economic situation. So, yes, I think that's more or less the reaction here in Madrid.
Mario Efthymiopoulos, let me ask you this. When you heard this news this morning, did you just shake your head or did you say, oh, yeah, no, the Europeans deserve this. We deserve this.
Well, I would say, like, as a European Union citizen, I would be very happy for my institutions and the institutions that were created over the years. But as a citizen of Greece, where we feel the fiscal crisis in our guts, basically on everything, I was very shocked, and I would say I still don't understand what the hell you're talking about.
Yeah, Sophie Petter in Paris. Let me ask you this: so if you read the citation, it says, the European Union has contributed to the advancement of peace and reconciliation, democracy and human rights in Europe. There is nowhere in there anything about the economy of Europe.
Well, exactly. And I think it's the strangeness of it coming just when there are so many divisions in Europe at the moment. You've got this real sense of Europe not really knowing how to get out of a crisis. The two big motor countries, France and Germany, not agreeing on what direction there is. And then suddenly this is the moment for the prize. This is something that could have been awarded at any point. It's odd timing.
Mario, this prize comes with, $1.2 million American. What do we do with the money? How do you split it up?
The bigger question is who will receive it for the European Union?
Yeah, who's going to go and make the speech, right?
Yeah, I don't know. To be honest, I truly don't know what they're going to do with the money. I presume also the money is definitely not going to the south of Europe. to be honest, the European Union, as a union of 27 member states, I think deserves it morally and ethically. It does not deserve it practically.
Yeah. Sophie, what do you think? Where does the money go?
Well, don't forget, the money's peanuts. I mean, the scale of the European economy and the scale of the problems, the scale of debt, I mean, it's just insignificant, really. I think it's much more in the symbolism that this prize has some sort of importance.
Sophie Petter is the Economist Bureau Chief in Paris. Mario Efthymiopoulos is with the Greek research firm Strategy International out of Thessaloniki. And Miguel Ancho Morado is a journalist in Madrid, Spain. Thanks, you guys, all very much for being here.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you very much.
Today through Sunday, heaven for beer drinkers, anyway, is to be found in Denver, Colorado. The Great American Beer Festival is on. 50,000 people, more than 2,000 craft brews, unlimited samples. Craft beers, you know, the ones with flavor. If you can't make it to Denver, you'll just have to settle for the craft beers that are available at your local purveyor, which are increasingly these days coming in, and I can't believe I have to say this, cans. From Colorado Public Radio, Zachary Barr reports.
This story starts not with a can, but with a bottle. You see, when microbrewed beer became popular in the 1980s and 90s, it came in a brown bottle. And then 10 years ago, Dale Katechis had a dream to be the first small brewer to put beer in a can.
The biggest fear was that the customer felt like bad beer comes in cans and it tastes like metal.
But first, a more immediate dilemma. The minimum order from the can manufacturer was 5 million cans. So Dale found a company that would sell him just one truckload, about 150,000 cans.
We thought that we had just bought, if things went well, several years' worth of cans.
And while beer behemoths such as Miller and Budweiser used automated machinery, smaller machines for smaller companies didn't exist. So Dale bought a simple hand-operated device. He set it on a picnic table inside a barn.
And we stood there, you know, two guys, you know, we had our hoodies on and it was freezing. This was late November 2002, and we were like kings of the world, you know?
And like that, craft beer was in cans, Dale's Pale Ale. But what about that stigma against the can? The same can that held the cheapest beer you could find back before you had kids, got fat, and started buying expensive beer. How did they convince people like you that the can was back?
We went out into the market every single day as hard as we could, cracking open cans of beer and said, would you try my beer? What do you think?
People liked it. Dale's Pale Ale was a surprise hit, and others took notice.
We saw that people were really starting to look at canned beer. Not only is the quality of the product is just as good as bottles, but it's really cool.
Jesse Brookstein is packaging manager at Avery Brewing in Boulder. It's one of 179 craft brewers around the country now selling their product in cans, up from zero a decade ago. He says his brewery added cans because customers wanted them, but it made business sense too.
The materials are less expensive. The shipping is less expensive. It keeps all light out, even better than a bottle, and they're great for hiking.
Today, Avery's canning line is filling cans of Ellie's Brown Ale. The cans shuffle around the small room on elevated tracks.
Hey, wait, is everything okay with the cans there?
This kind of high-tech but small canning line is a new invention. Also new, can co-ops. They specialize in filling small can orders. These developments make the rise of craft beer in cans possible. But ultimately, it comes down to this. You're standing in the beer aisle. Bottles or cans?
I prefer the can, because most of the good beers now are being canned.
Mike McDowell's just pulled a 12-pack of Dale's Pale Ale off the shelf.
I like how it feels. I like how it drinks. I'm a can guy.
For emphasis, Mike raises his hand, firmly gripping an imaginary beer can. In Boulder, I'm Zachary Barr for Marketplace.
Back to the vice presidential debate for just a couple of minutes now. By all accounts, this matchup was a bit sparkier than the one last week. There were even some throwdowns, you might call them, offered. We spent some time today trying to figure out a different way to talk about that. So we called up one of the co-founders of RapGenius.com. That's a website that explains and interprets hip-hop and rap lyrics. Mahbood Mogadam is on the line with us. Hey.
What up? Good to be here.
What up? We're doing the debate thing. That's what up. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to kind of see how this goes. We're going to play a little tape, and I'm going to get your rap interpretation thereof, all right?
All right.
Here we go. So here's the first cut. It's a little bit long, but let's play this one.
It's been done before. It's precisely what we're proposing.
It has never been done before.
It's been done a couple of times, actually.
It has never been
done before. Jack Kennedy lowered tax rates, increased growth. Ronald Reagan.
Oh, now you're Jack Kennedy.
Ronald Reagan.
Boom, right? I mean, come on. So how does this rate, do you think, is like a throwdown, is like a battle between these guys?
It doesn't even rhyme. That's the problem. You know?
Wait, rap doesn't have to rhyme. Does rap have to rhyme?
No, it's true. But it's not even in verse. If they would do it in free verse or anything, it would be more artful, especially with the Veeps.
So if you were gonna Rap Genius like one of these things, what would you do with it? How would you do it?
Thank you for using Rap Genius as a verb, by the way. That means a lot to me.
Because it's true, right?
Malarney sounds like an interesting word. I'm about to go rap genius it.
Malarkey.
Break that down too.
Malarkey.
I'm gonna malark it out and figure this out.
It's English for you're full of it, basically.
Full of malarkey, I eat at Sharky's. It's off the dome. I don't want you to think that I prepared that or
no, you did good. Listen, thanks a lot for helping us out today. I appreciate it.
Much love. We gotta chill. When I'm back in LA, we gotta kick it.
You got it. Mahbood Mogadam from RapGenius.com, believe it or not.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out on a Friday, hope springs eternal for the United States Postal Service. The post office said today it's going to make it through the month without going broke thanks to the presidential election. Campaigns, candidates, and interest groups are sending out more electioneering mailers this year than ever before, almost $300 million worth, and that's only through August. Not for nothing on this, but we've got a special collaboration with Frontline about campaign finance that we're working on, which interestingly kind of hinges on political mailings. Tune in to see it. It's October 30th. Frontline. Yes, a bit of shameless self-promotion. I know. Sorry. All right, we're done. We got to go. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. The stock market today, kind of eh, in a kind of lousy week. The major indices all down 2% or more. Three Music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money.
At the time, even though I didn't have the financial means to afford the school she chose, I agreed to take out Parent Plus loans. Today, I now owe $130,000.
Student loans and life's other financial questions from you. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.